Hi everybody, welcome to Poly 203. I'm really glad to see you, and I hope that you can see me fine this time. I am recording this lecture on both Zoom, which I'll post to the class website before the lecture time at 11 o'clock today, and also I'm audio recording it just in case as a backup. I understand that the other day the video didn't record, and I apologize for that, but you've got the audio, and hopefully today we'll get the video working properly as well. Today I'm going to go through a couple announcements and then talk about the last chapter, chapter 17 of Deadly Justice. So let me switch to my slides and I'll be right with you. Okay, this is your professor again. I think you see me maybe in a little corner. I'm going to stop that because you really don't need to see me in the little corner. And I'm going to go through these slides. Thanks. There was a question from some of you about things that have come up with regards to the readings. And I wanted to reassure you that while we have made a number of adjustments in the syllabus, and the syllabus was set before the class started, the revised version of everything is accurate on my class website. So please pay attention to the class website. I'm going to be giving you also an exercise this afternoon and a quiz as well. Both of those will be due on Friday, and I'll be giving you a quiz every week. That'll always be due on the Friday of each week. Okay, so I know that's a change. It's probably a pain in the neck for some of you, but it's a class and we do have to, assess your performance one way or another. And now that we've gotten through all the many details of Deadly Justice, as of today, we'll start reviewing that material. And believe me, that's going to be helpful for you for the final exam. Okay? So that's our plan. And also, I've heard from many of you by email, but there's 400 of you, and I have not heard from anywhere close to even one third of you. So I'm always happy to hear your feedback. I wanted to give another one update. One is directly related to the lecture on Monday, and that is that the graph that I gave you about the number of jurisdictions that have an active death penalty statute has already changed as of Monday. The governor of Colorado signed the bill to eliminate the death penalty. So if you want to read about that, you can Google it or look at this link in the New York Times. There were only three people on the Colorado death row, but you might note that one of them was Nathan Dunlop, who was a killer, killed I don't know how many people in a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado. So his death sentence, like the two others, has been converted to commuted to life in prison without parole. And Colorado becomes the latest state to abolish the death penalty through a vote of the legislature and the signature of the governor. So we're down to 30 jurisdictions. It's a pretty big shift from 47 jurisdictions in 1960 and 40 jurisdictions as recently as 2006. So we'll see how the U.S. Supreme Court would interpret such a trend. It's certainly a trend in a certain direction towards abolition, but there's still 30 jurisdictions that have a legally available death penalty. Now, many of them have not used it much, as you know. A couple other announcements from the recent news. The virus is stopping executions in some states. Texas and other states have granted stays. So that's an interesting development. As I mentioned, I think there was some discussion or questions, confusions related to some of your discussion sections and also the revised schedule for the class. For the class schedule, please monitor the class website and note that, you know, this week we're on schedule as we're on to the revised schedule. And next week we'll start discussing the ghost of an innocent man. There's been a few questions about the nature of participation in your discussion recitation sections. And I wanted to reassure you that some of the TAs are organizing their discussions, not as Zoom meetings, in person, so to speak, but through online participation in forums through Sakai. And they, as well as I, will continue to have office hours through Zoom. So I encourage you to participate in those if you have any questions or just want to say hi. The last thing I wanted to mention before I start is yesterday I went to campus, and it's kind of eerie on campus right now. Everything is closed. I mean, not everything, but most things are closed. Hamilton Hall was locked. And the only people that seem to be around are groundskeepers, and they're busy making the place beautiful. Campus is usually extremely beautiful right around graduation time, and I'm sure it's going to be really beautiful this year, although so far it looks like no one will be here to see it. It's really strange. Okay, let's go to chapter 17. The main thing is evaluating the core question in our book, which was, is the modern death penalty consistent with the goals of the Gregg versus Georgia decision, or does it fail the test that the justices said the system failed in 1972 in Furman? So in order to assess this question about whether we passed the Gregg test or flunked the Furman test, I want to review exactly what that means. And so the next few slides are copied from earlier slides that I had given you in the first couple weeks of the semester. So the puzzle is this. In Furman, the justices say that the death penalty is arbitrary, it's flawed, and serves no useful purpose. It's flawed in a number of ways, but the main critique is that it doesn't make sense and it's not reserved for the worst of the worst. It's capricious and arbitrary, etc. In Gregg, 1976, the justices say that the new systems have promise and that they're constitutionally acceptable because they narrowly target the death penalty on the supposedly the worst of the worst, and that they guarantee that a substantial proportion of those eligible to get the death penalty will indeed get it, although they always leave a little bit of wiggle room through the Magotha concept, room for grace by the jury. And so the idea is that the new system should be indeed narrowly targeted, and it should inflict the death penalty on a really large proportion of the people who deserve it. And it should not give the death penalty to people who don't deserve it because their crimes are not the worst, or because they were not the most deserving criminals. They didn't have any mitigating factors. So now that we've got almost 45 years of experience with the new death penalty, let's just see if it passes that test. So another element of the Furman decision that we have to take seriously is that the process is wanton and freakish, and it's like being struck by lightning among convicted murderers. Justice Brennan really focused on this issue in 1972, and he said that we couldn't accept a system that was so capricious and arbitrary, and that many of the people who've been given the death penalty are in fact not guilty of the most heinous crimes. The justices in 1972 were concerned about the impact of race, but they did not have a study that showed them that there was systematic racial bias, although they were suspicious of that. And this is 1972. Further, they said that there weren't sufficient procedural safeguards. It was extremely rare. And that rareness as a critique led to one potential solution in several states, including North Carolina, as well as Louisiana, simply make the death penalty mandatory for all first-degree homicide. And then the justices ruled that that was unconstitutional. It had to be an individualized assessment. So on the one hand, they're saying that it's too rare. On the other hand, they're not allowing a solution that would make it extremely common. And that solution, it's important to note, was politically acceptable to many state legislatures, including the one here in our state. The justices in 1972 also raised the issue of deterrence. And they raised the issue, though, in a very different way than the way that you might have thought about it in the past. The way they raised it in 1972 was whether it's acceptable to make an example of somebody. Deterrence involves the concept that by executing an individual, you would show that the punishment is so severe that other people will be dissuaded from committing homicide. And the justices in 1972 said that that implies that that individual who's being executed is really being treated not as an individual human who deserves death because of the heinousness of his crime or her crime, but in order to make an example. So that's a important element of the deterrence argument that isn't widely used, but it's something that we have to take into consideration as well. On the deterrence issue, I should also say that in 1972, there was not much evidence presented to the justices about the statistical merits of the deterrence argument, but in 1976, there was. And in Gregg, the argument that there is a strong deterrent effect of the death penalty was a substantial part of the logic and the reasoning of bringing back the death penalty in 1976. Okay, so to fix those flaws in 1976, we ended up with a number of improvements or revisions to the death penalty system. And these revisions really characterize the quote-unquote modern death penalty system in the United States. It's supposed to be more accurate. So it has these characteristics. It's supposed to have narrow targeting, specify only the most heinous crimes. It should inflict the death penalty on a substantial proportion of those criminals who are guilty of those narrowly targeted crimes. It should also allow for the relative weighting of aggravators against mitigators. And this is supposed to ensure that not only are the crimes the worst crimes, but also the criminals are the most deserving. By weighing the mitigators, we could say, well, perhaps somebody generated one of these terrible crimes, but they, for whatever reason, are less culpable. For example, perhaps they were under the influence of somebody else, or perhaps the victim had actually participated in the crime, or in some way there was a mitigating factor that made this criminal not as culpable as others. So we had to weight those aggravators and mitigators. It also mandated the two-stage trial, the guilt phase and the penalty phase. And it mandated also a proportionality review by state Supreme Courts. So all of these procedural corrections were supposed to fix the problems in Furman. So that's the point of our entire book, is just to see whether these things have worked. So let's look at a summary of the evidence and to see whether we fail the Furman test, that is, the same problems that used to be there are still there, or do we pass the Gregg test, the new penalty with all those safeguards, means that the death penalty today, the modern death penalty, would not have the flaws that were identified in the old death penalty in Furman. Okay, so we're going to look at a number of bits of evidence. The book that you read, Deadly Justice, is really organized around empirical statistical assessments of all these things. I'm not going to go through all of them in today's slides, but if you review the book, you'll see that all of these things are covered. So is the death penalty so rare and capricious as to be similar to being struck by lightning? So to assess that, we want to know how often is it used and whether it's reserved for the most deserving criminals who made the worst crimes. We should look at racial bias. That was an issue that was discussed in Furman, but where they didn't have strong statistical evidence and studies had not been done as deeply as they've been done in modern times. Are there other forms of caprice or arbitrariness, such as a geographical focus on just a few places? What's the evidence now about deterrence? What's the evidence about delays from death sentences to execution, reversals, etc., the possibility that these are psychologically torturing to the inmates? We should talk about methods of execution because those have changed over the years, as you know, and the possibility of botched executions constituting torture. And then the issue of evolving standards of decency that we talked about yesterday. So we're going to talk about many of these. Some of them I'm not going to have time to go through, but you can certainly browse through the book and you'll see each chapter of the book assesses one or another of these items, and as well as some others. So the graph that I have on the slide right now indicates the total number of homicides in the United States in the blue line. And you can see that there was a surge in homicides around the mid-1980s till about the early 1990s. And then quite a substantial decline in the number of homicides from the mid to early 1990s. You can see a little peak in 2001, and I want you to know that that's a real peak, and actually that's the 9/11 bombings. I think there were 5,000 people killed, or some enormous number, and so that really shows up in the data and there in 2001. That's not a mistake in the data. And then the numbers decline. Also, in the red line, you can see the number of homicides in states that have a legally available death penalty. And you can see the vast majority of homicides occur in states that have a legally available death penalty. You can also see in the period from 2007 to present that there's a slightly greater spread in the difference between the death penalty states and the entire United States is due to the fact that states are dropping out one by one during that period from 2007 to present. So anyway, these are the numbers of homicides, and you can see that from 1972, 73, 74, 75, up until about 1980, the number of homicides and death states rose to be almost equal to the national total, and then it stayed slightly below that. And that's just as the states enacted their new death penalty laws after the Furman decision. Okay, so anyway, the vast majority of homicides are in states with a legally available death penalty. Well, if we just compare the number of homicides with the number of executions, and we divide by 100 so that we can see how many executions occur per 100 homicides, then we can see the graph on the left of the slide that you're seeing now, which implies that the maximum number of executions per 100 homicides was 0.6, and that number came in 1998. So that's 98 executions, which is the number we had in 1998. And that represents not even 1% of the number of homicides in that year. Similarly, on the right-hand side, the number of death sentences per homicides, again, only counting the homicides in the states where the death penalty was legally available, has never been more than 2%. It's never even reached that level, just 2 per 100, 2%. And today, after, say, about 2001, 2002, the number has consistently been significantly below 1% and even down below 0.5%. Okay, so per 100 homicides, we would expect there to be less than one half of one death sentence. So it would take 200 death sentences to generate 200 homicides to generate one death sentence. So is that consistent with Furman in that it's unconstitutionally rare, or is it consistent with Gregg and that a substantial proportion of homicide offenders who commit certain types of homicides would get the death penalty? It kind of depends on whether there's neurotargeting. Are these consistently only those who blow up a building or torture their victims or something like that? But in any case, we can certainly see that it's extremely statistically rare. In the book, we have another version of this graph, but I've updated it to compare the total number of homicides in the United States since 1972. The share of those homicides that were in death states, so that's almost 800,000 homicides since 1972 in states that had a legally available death penalty. Those numbers go up only through 2018. And then the total number of executions and the total number of death sentences compared to those. And these numbers are so small that you can barely see them on the graph. Okay, but the labels are there. There's up through 2019, there was almost 1,500 death sentences. As of today, I think the number is 1,515 or something like that. There's maybe another 20 or 30 that have occurred since the end of that data series. But you can see that it's not proportionate. It's extremely low numbers. Another question that was of concern to the justices was geographical arbitrariness. So here I updated a graph that's in the book, which is the number of death sentences per state, or number of executions per state in the period from 1900 through 1972. That's the before Furman. And you can see that New York, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Texas, California, and North Carolina had over 400 executions in the period of 1900 through 1972. And you can see the distribution that was widely distributed across various states. And Kentucky had over 200 executions in that 72-year period. And there's other states with fewer, but if we look at the period after Gregg, it's obvious that there's a much tighter geographical concentration in just one state, which is Texas, and no other state in the modern period would even appear on the graph on the left-hand side. So the death penalty has become much less common, but also much more highly concentrated in just a few places. Here we have a distribution of how many executions there are per state, and you've seen this graph from the book, but I updated it with the most recent data, and also the number of death sentences. And you can see that the death sentences, there are three states, California, Florida, and Texas, with large numbers of death sentences, but only one state with large numbers of executions. Okay, so as we go through the system from a death sentence, most of which get overturned, to an execution, the geographical concentration gets even greater. I'm not going to review in this short single lecture, you know, all the evidence about cost, racial bias, deterrence, and other factors, but just looking at the total number of death sentences and executions in their geographic compared to the number of homicides, and then the geographical concentration by state, it's clear that we have not solved the arbitrariness and the capriciousness question, and it's still similar to being struck by lightning. So if we review the problems that the justices mentioned in Furman, the first one was the low rate of use invites or makes possible caprice and arbitrariness, that it's not reserved for the worst of the worst. And that has definitely not been resolved. We do not have a high rate of use, and we don't have narrow targeting because of the common use of such things as particularly heinous and cruel or the felony murder concept, which makes almost any routine robbery ending in a death eligible for the death penalty. And most states that have the death penalty have one of those catch-all aggravators, particularly the felony murder aggravator, makes it so that many, many crimes are eligible for the death penalty, but very few are selected. So that concept of a wide net but a low rate of use is the exact opposite of narrow targeting and substantial proportion. That was a promise of the Gregg decision. What can we say about geographical concentration? We can say that that's an even worse problem today than it was in the pre-Furman era. Death sentences are concentrated in Philadelphia, Houston, Los Angeles, and executions are concentrated in Houston and just a few other places, mostly in Texas and Oklahoma. So there is a lot of freakishness that the same crime that takes place in Atlanta, Georgia, or New Orleans, Louisiana, or somewhere else will not be met with a death sentence with the same likelihood as if the crime occurs somewhere else. And further, even if there is a death sentence, if that death sentence is in Los Angeles, it's not likely ever to be carried out. Whereas if the death sentence is in Houston, it has a much higher likelihood of being carried out. So these are elements of caprice or arbitrariness that are unrelated to the heinousness of the crime and should therefore be unrelated to the odds that you'll get the death penalty or that it'll be carried out. So there are real issues about arbitrariness. Are there extra legal disparities? Gender, we talked about, it's a huge disparity. Women are extremely unlikely to be sentenced to death. And when they are, as we discussed, it's for different types of crimes, more likely to be family, within the family crimes, either they kill their spouse or their children, they render themselves much more likely to be sentenced to death as compared to if there's a stranger crime. For men, it's the opposite. And also men constitute the vast majority of people who have been sentenced to death. Further, with regards to victims, female victims are much more likely to lead to a death sentence than male victims. So there's a huge gender disparity in the death penalty that has not really gotten very much attention, but it's unconstitutional because there's supposed to be equal protection of the law, and the fact that you are a female or a male should not make the justice system respond differently to your crime or to your victimization. But it does. Gender matters a lot. Race matters even more. And in particular, we should pay attention to the race of the victim as compared to the race of the perpetrator. The race of the victim matters a lot, and the combined races of the perpetrators and the victims, and especially when we add to that the genders of the perpetrators and the victims, mean that there is very little equality in the system. Okay, so all in all, we cannot say that there's been narrow targeting. States have not, they just haven't done that. They haven't imposed the death penalty only for cases where one kills a police officer or a corrections official or something like that. Although some states did have laws like that. The law in New York State was like that. Only a few homicides were eligible. In Oregon, they just recently revised their statute so that it's extremely narrowly targeted and will probably never be used. But in most cases, there was a complete failure of narrow targeting because of the use of such things as felony, homicide, and the concept of crimes that are especially heinous and cruel. That's so vague and leaves so much to the discretion of the district attorney that we really can't say that there has been any substantial narrow targeting. Further, it's not true that a substantial proportion of those who commit these crimes get the death penalty. It's just hasn't happened. Okay, on deterrence, this was an issue in the Gregg. In Gregg, there was a lot of promise and argument about the value of the death penalty as a deterrent. But it's a settled matter today. I think the statistical evidence is in on deterrence, and the evidence is that there is no evidence one way or the other. It is so difficult to establish causal arguments about who is being influenced by what, that the review by the National Academy of Sciences just a few years ago indicated that we should make no conclusions whatsoever on either side of the matter with regards to deterrence. So deterrence was promised in Gregg, and it was one of the justifications that the justices used for reestablishing the death penalty, and that state legislatures used, and it's something that makes sense to a lot of people, but it's simply, there is no evidence for it. Further, I should note that the justices in Furman were suggesting that even if there were a deterrent value, it does not comport with human dignity to kill somebody simply to make an example. And that's definitely a moral perspective worth thinking about. And then another problem that was really not there in Furman but is there now is the issue of evolving standards. We're using the death penalty less and less, and states are abandoning their connection to the death penalty. So it could be that the degree of use and the geographical concentration of the use of the death penalty in just a small number of jurisdictions is going to render invalid the death penalty on the basis of evolving standards of decency. Okay. Now, there's a number of problems that were not discussed in Furman, but which are really substantial in the modern death penalty system. The first of these is innocence. Even though innocence has been a perennial problem with the death penalty, and I've mentioned this 100 times in class, that the Salem witch trials led to the execution, burning at the stake of a number of women in the early years of the colonial experience in the United States, but they were not guilty. Okay? There has been no period when innocence was not a substantial problem with the criminal justice system, but we never paid attention to it. Today, we're paying attention to it, and we've noted that over 160 people previously sentenced to death have been later found to be innocent. That ignores the number of people who were never discovered to be innocent or legally declared to be innocent, who were in fact executed. And many of you have read books about Carlos de Luna or other inmates who were in fact executed, where there was substantial evidence that probably they were not guilty of the crime. Many of you read the book about Troy Davis, a similar case. So innocence is something that the Furman decision was not really focused on, but which is now an additional problem with the death penalty in the modern period. Similarly, reversals. The fact that 70% of all death sentences are reversed on appeal was not an issue for the justices in 1972, but it certainly would be if there were a constitutional review of all the aspects of the death penalty today. Stays of execution have become typical. That is, the majority of all scheduled executions are canceled. So when we make a stay of execution the most common outcome of a scheduled execution, that raises issues that were not there in Furman. And when we delay those executions even to the last minute, at the last minute, it raises issues of torture. Similarly, executions typically take place now more than 20 years after the death sentence. And so those very, very long delays on death row raise the issue of whether we've really sentenced somebody to a penalty of life without the possibility of parole, followed by the remote chance, the low probability that the execution will be carried out. That was the way a justice described it, and a judge described the system in California, and I think it applies to most states. So those executing innocent people, sentencing somebody to death and then reversing, delaying the execution at the very last minute, or having very, very long periods of time on death row before some random probability of being executed, all of those things could be considered to be elements of human torture. And so those were not there in the Furman decision, but they're certainly there in the current system of death penalty that we have in the United States. Another element that was not so much there in the early historical period, but is there today, is that governors don't commute death sentences. It's become a political nightmare for governors, and they simply don't do it very commonly. It happens only very rarely. It was actually much more common, including in North Carolina in historical periods, it was not uncommon that governors would commute the sentence of death. And that was considered a judicial safeguard for cases where there was a lack of certainty, sometimes in innocence cases. Notice that they're commuting the sentence, they're not pardoning the individual. They're simply commuting the sentence so that the death penalty is canceled and they suffer the penalty of life without parole. And that's just not happening anymore, and I have a slide about that in the next slide. The final thing that I'll mention that was not a problem in Furman, but is a problem in Gregg, in the post-Gregg period, is cost. And the cost is not a moral or a legal issue, but it certainly is something that has changed the political calculus of the death penalty as the cost of it has risen astronomically. And very few people are seeing their executions carried out. So the cost per execution is a little bit crazy. Now, on this issue of commutations, I just went through my database to make this slide yesterday, and it is quite shocking. There's 300 and some commutations out of 8,000 people sentenced to death in the United States. Just about 306 have been commuted. But these commutations have mostly come in mass commutations when governors have declared that they will empty their state's death row. The biggest one was in Illinois when the governor was so depressed or so shocked by the scandals coming out of the Chicago Police Department and the exonerations of four individuals in Illinois who had been tortured into confessing to crimes they hadn't committed. He emptied death row. He did not at the same time eliminate the death penalty. That happened in Illinois in 2011 when another 15 people were also commuted. So most of the commutations in the United States, the vast majority, in fact, have come in these clumps or clusters. Just 2 days ago, the governor of Colorado abolished the death penalty and he commuted the sentences of the three people currently on death row in Colorado. So we can see those characteristics here as well. So commutations just aren't happening anymore. So what can we say altogether? You've read the book. I would love to get your feedback about the argument, the care with which we've made the argument, any suggestions about material that we should include, things where you think we need more attention because it's confusing, things where we need more attention because we just skipped over it too quickly, or things that you think that we could shorten or skip or condense. So I'd love to get your feedback. I'm sure we'll do a second edition of this book, and having your feedback would be very, very helpful. Now, what can we say about the substance of the conclusion that we're all interested in? Should there be a death penalty or not? I think one thing for you to think about, and I'm not going to give you advice about this, is the philosophical or the moral perspective. We decided in our book that as political scientists, we could be most effective avoiding this topic. That is, these are really difficult issues. And people can disagree with them, and it's difficult to know who's right and who's wrong. It's a moral question where we all have to come to our own conclusions. So we avoided these questions in our book, and we said maybe we could assess the death penalty with regards to empirical matters and trends about whether it really works and is effective, so that even if one approved of the death penalty on the moral perspective, one's philosophical approach was in favor of retribution, deterrence, or some other argument in favor of the death penalty, after looking at the evidence, one would still come to the conclusion that it is not fulfilling its potential, Okay, so we've avoided the issue of morality, saying we don't even need to go there. We don't need to make a moral argument to assess the value of the death penalty. Furthermore, we really don't feel qualified to give a moral lesson. I don't think that my morals are necessarily better than somebody else's, but I do know how to count, and I do know how to assess whether the death penalty is fulfilling its mission. Okay. Now, I do want to mention that I'm going to give you an assignment about who deserves death. And that assignment should really raise some questions for you, because it's not only about the death penalty, but it's also about who deserves what level of punishment for which particular kinds of homicide. And it's in this class, we're talking about the death penalty, but district attorneys throughout the country have to decide whether they should charge a particular homicide as first degree, second degree. Sometimes some states have the idea of third degree homicide or manslaughter. It could be negligent or non-negligent manslaughter. There's all kinds of ways to kill people that don't lead to the same punishments. But all of those have in common the idea that somebody lost their life. And so it is very difficult, but actually a very common practice that we have to make judgments about which crimes are worse than others. So I'm going to give you an assignment about that so that you can really think through those philosophical questions. Now, as an empirical matter, here's where I feel like I personally and we as political scientists are on much stronger grounds, much stronger ground. We can assess the actual functioning of the death penalty system. And our assessment is very, very clear. It does not meet the standards of fairness laid out as problems in Furman, and it does not rise to the level of proportionality, narrow targeting, and so on that were supposed to be the promises of the new modern system in the Gregg v. Georgia decision in 1976. Furthermore, there's been a lot of court cases and reforms designed to chip away at problems such as executing the intellectually disabled, executing juveniles, and other things. None of those reforms have succeeded collectively in generating a system that's fair. So our assessment is that even if one wanted to have a death penalty system as a moral question, the one that we have has failed, and it's failed miserably. There is no way to assess the system and to come to the conclusion that it's working as one would wish, and that it's working as one would wish. There is an obvious question: could it be fixed? That was the whole point of Gregg. We've been here. In 1972, the justices revolutionized criminal justice by saying that the death penalty was so flawed it was unconstitutional, and that every state in the nation that wanted to have a death penalty system had to rewrite its laws from scratch. And so the states did that. And so the evidence is in now, after 45 years of experience with these new and improved death penalty statutes, the evidence shows, and that's what we've laid out in the book, and that's what we've talked about in this class from the very beginning, that those Herculean efforts to ensure fairness in this context are just, they're not working. That was the conclusion in Colorado earlier this week when they abolished the death penalty in that state. I can see this might happen in other states. We've had speakers coming into class who suggested that Virginia and North Carolina might be among the next states to abolish. And I think that we're on a trend where people can't ignore the facts that we're laying out, that many people have laid out, and that we've been reviewing in this class. Death penalty system, no matter what one would like to think about it, when you assess it for its actual workings, is a broken system. Thanks so much for your attention. I'll talk to you soon.